for scenario analysis to be really successful, it has to be a state of being within the members of within the members of a firm. So in other words, regularly carrying out scenario analysis encourages those sorts of rich conversations. It encourages people challenging each other's worldviews, challenging the mental models, conceptions that they have of the world. You could actually argue that scenario analysis is very little about the future at all. So the main reason, I would argue, why most scenario analysis happens has to do with the present. So it's about understanding what's going on now in the present better. And one way to understand what's going on now in the present better is to think creatively and expansively about different ways in which the future might unfold. It's really important to understand how institutions work in the countries and regions where you're operating. And it's also really important to understand cultural issues. So I always argue that that business is fundamentally about relationships. And there are lots of different elements to language. One thing is the whole idea of context and the relationship between what people say and what people mean.
Moin friends, Tannenpanne here. My conversation today is with Dr. Neil Piper, Head of Education and Student Experience in the Faculty of Business and Law at the Bourke Black University of London. We talk about his research, which consists of strategic foresight. And what I've learned from this is that it's not about predicting the future, but use these tools to understand the present better. And another passion of him is the management and political economy in Latin America. Business is always about relationships and the environment you're in. And we talk about that, and he gives us interesting insights and also the important role of language, so that it's not, or there's always kind of a difference between what is spoken and what is actually meant by the spoken words. And yeah, so it's really interesting conversation, and have fun. This is Tandem Panda, a podcast about language learning and sharing different experiences with people from around the world. Hello, Neil.
Hello.
Birmingham. Nice to have you here. And you have an interesting research field. So I just could catch up international business and strategic foresight. And actually, with international business, maybe I have some picture in my mind, but strategic foresight, I have no clue. So yeah, it would be really great if you can like introduce me to that topic, and then maybe we can deep dive or deeper into this research topic, and what actually are the questions that you're looking at and trying to answer.
Sure. So strategic foresight essentially is about how strategists, and in general people like corporate leaders, policymakers, think about the future. So almost all strategic activity, I would argue, is fundamentally about planning for the future. That's why we talk about strategic planning. Mm-hmm. However, the future is inherently unknowable. And however much some, for example, consultancies may claim to offer predictive analysis or predictive judgment about the future, in reality, it's impossible to predict the future. So given that strategy is interested in the future, yet the future is inherently unknowable, strategic foresight essentially is about how we try to make sense of the future and try to make sense of the nature of the uncertainties that we face when we think about the future.
Okay, so which target values are you really looking at if you talk about the future? Are there some specific numbers you're looking at, or is that thinking of numbers the wrong way to look at things in the future?
usually strategic foresight involves qualitative approaches. So there are various different methodologies. And usually, for example, the approach that I'm most interested in is scenario analysis. And I teach scenario analysis quite often in a variety of contexts. And scenario analysis is often set up as a contrasting approach to forecasting. So when we produce a forecast, usually we're producing a single predictive judgment about what's going to happen in the future. We talk about single point forecasts, and that's usually produced using some sort of mathematical model, usually a probability based mathematical model that involves, sometimes in quite sophisticated ways, projecting what has happened in the past into the future. So essentially doing statistical analyses that predict what's going to happen in the future based on what's happened in the past. Now, that's fine in the short term, and what we mean by short term will depend on context, but that's fine in the short term when there are quite a lot of things about how the future is going to unfold that we already know, so what we call predetermined elements. However, the problem with forecast-based approaches is that when there's a lot of uncertainty, so in other words, there are a lot of things that we don't know about how the future is likely to unfold, then forecasts are unreliable. So, you know, we see that in, for example, weather forecasting. In the UK, we're obsessed with trying to forecast the weather. And we see the issues with long-term weather forecasting because there's so much that we don't know about what weather systems are going to be like a long way into the future. So there's that. And then also there's the issue that forecasting based approaches don't really work when what happens in the future isn't really reminiscent of what happened in the past. So if you think about phenomena like the rise of Donald Trump as a political force in the US, there weren't really, during the time that Donald Trump emerged as a serious presidential contender, there weren't really any reference points in terms of historical figures who had been like Donald Trump. And there wasn't really a history in the US of candidates like him being elected. And so what that meant essentially was that political experts in US politics didn't know how to deal with that, because any kind of expertise or points of reference when we think about the future usually are based on what happened in the past. So strategic foresight, specifically scenario analysis, is about acknowledging that there's a lot of uncertainty when we think about the future, that the future's unknowable, but thinking about how we can approach the future so that we analyze it and deal with it and respond to it better. So it's not about predicting the future, it's about being able to deal with uncertainty in the future better.
Interesting. So if I sum it up in my words, so this base models, you have an idea, or I would say for easier terms, like a linear behavior, if I can call it like that, and then you put that behavior to the future. But if you don't know what could happen, because there are more variables and also uncertainties, what you said, you can't predict that. But the approach that I understand now that you use are scenario analysis. So in these scenarios, you put in ideas or possibilities what can or could happen, but still, how do you deal with that uncertainty, or what elements can you really put in this scenario analysis?
Okay, so scenario analysis takes as its starting point the idea that in reality, when we think about the future, there isn't one way that the future can go. So if I think back, certainly in my own life, say to 20 years ago, my life could have gone in one of any number of ways between then and now. However, most thinking about the future that we do, and certainly most forecasting that we do, identifies a single way that the future can unfold. So it's thinking about the future in the singular. And the starting point with scenario analysis is that we actually need to think about the future in the plural. So instead of thinking about the future, we need to think about possible futures. So there are a number of different ways to undertake scenario analysis. There are a number of different methodologies. What you end up with most of these is a number, very often four, different, rich, descriptive narratives, stories about what the future might look like. So it's a slightly different mentality or mindset on the future. It's the idea of the future as being a multifaceted thing, thinking in terms of futures rather than thinking about the future or our future.
I see. This reminds me somehow of Doctor Strange in Marvel with his different future scenarios and the possibilities. But can you actually count or calculate the possibilities which scenario is most likely to happen? Or if you have to choose one, do you merge the different scenarios, or how do you deal with that to give an answer to a specific question?
So the main, I suppose, criterion that's used when evaluating scenarios is plausibility. So forecasting and quantitative methods, tend to be about assessing the future in terms of probability. So most forecasting is probability based, I would say. Scenario analysis, because it's a narrative, qualitative approach, involves, instead of probability, it involves plausibility. So basically, scenario analysis is a group exercise. Groups develop scenarios. There is a methodology that is followed, and there are a number of different methodologies, but all of those methodologies basically are about weighing up the things that we do know, the predetermined elements, against the uncertainties, the things that we don't know. And the big criteria with all of those is that basically, for something to be used in a scenario, the group that's producing the scenarios needs to be convinced that it's plausible.
Okay.
So in other words, the members of the group producing the scenario need to agree, yes, this is plausible. Now, that's quite an intangible thing. So plausibility is whatever the group agrees that it is, but that's the overriding criterion in evaluating scenarios, plausibility. So, and then it's not just plausibility from the point of view of the group producing the scenarios. Usually, a scenario analysis is carried out for a client. So there will be not necessarily a paying client, but there will be somebody or an organization or a set of stakeholders who will receive the scenarios at the end. And the scenarios need to be plausible to them as well. So plausibility is the thing that's really important.
Okay, that's interesting. But still, if we go back to this example with Donald Trump, and the group has, from their expertise or from their knowledge of the past, and have the opinion that this would or could not happen, are there measurements or ways that still gives this possibility a chance, or how do you deal actually with these kind of uncertainties?
Well, I think that this gets to another element of scenario analysis. So the temptation, I think, quite often is to think of scenario analysis as being another way to try to predict the future. I've already said that I don't believe that it's possible to predict the future. So I would argue that scenario analysis is not about predicting the future. So what that means is that you can do a scenario analysis exercise. You can come up with your, let's say, four scenarios, because in the most commonly used methodology for scenario analysis, you usually end up with four scenarios. So you can do your scenario analysis, come up with your four scenarios, and none of those four scenarios can happen. Mm-hmm. But that's not the point of scenario analysis. Scenario analysis is about, well, it's about a number of things, but predicting the future is not one of them. So scenario analysis can be about stress testing strategic plans. So you come up with your multiple scenarios, you look at your current strategic plans, and you think about how they would withstand each of those scenarios.
I see.
And that's a very common use of scenario analysis, to sort of stress test strategic plans and to do a sort of horizon scanning exercise for possible threats that might be coming. Scenario analysis can also be useful in terms of getting people thinking about early warnings that things might not be going according to plan. But I would also argue, so there are a number of uses for the scenarios themselves, and there are very famous examples of scenarios that companies and governments have produced. So the most common approach to scenario analysis was developed within Shell, and some of the Shell scenarios are very well known. However, I would argue that scenario analysis is at least as much about the process as about the scenarios. So scenario analysis is fundamentally a group activity. Mm-hmm. It's an activity that involves people talking to each other and involves people having richer conversations than it's usually possible for them to have in their day-to-day working lives. So that strategic conversation is really important. And the idea is that in having those conversations, people are challenging each other's worldviews, challenging the mental models that each other have of the world. Mm-hmm. And that in doing that, first of all, it's an important team building exercise. And secondly, it's about developing greater strategic agility. So one of the big tests for any organization, and I would argue that one of the things that differentiated those organizations that managed reasonably well during the COVID pandemic and those that didn't, is the ability to change approach, change direction when events change. So that's a sort of strategic agility. And I would argue that embedding scenario analysis in the decision-making processes of firms can help firms to develop that agility.
Okay. So if I put it in my words, so in engineering, we have a word called feedback loop. So if you want to deal with these uncertainties, you use sensors for actually measuring the environment and then put that new information back to actually do a control loop for that. Is that also similar to that? And how often do you have to really do this, use the new feedback and do this whole loop again of discussing in the group or evaluating your new scenarios?
I think that depends on the circumstances. I mean, there's a lot of research on scenario analysis that argues that the companies that do scenario analysis best don't do it as a one-off exercise. So, in other words, if you look at a company like Shell, Shell is the most famous practitioner, I suppose, of scenario analysis. And essentially, Shell has been constantly carrying out scenario analysis, developing scenarios for basically the last 40 years. So there's constant scenario analysis going on within Shell, both developing new scenarios and exploring existing scenarios. And that's about creating a culture whereby scenario analysis and the things involved in doing scenario analysis become part of how decisions are taken within the firm. A part of the culture of the firm. So one of the top books on scenario analysis by two authors, George Cairns and George Wright, argue that for scenario analysis to be really successful, it has to be a state of being within the members of a within the members of a firm. So in other words, regularly carrying out scenario analysis encourages those sorts of rich conversations. It encourages people challenging each other's worldviews, challenging the mental models, conceptions that they have of the world. And that's where the real benefit from scenario analysis comes, in having that embedded within the cultures of firms.
That's interesting. Okay, so I have a better understanding now. So it's really a culture thing or a philosophy, a kind of thinking for an organization to really be able to react to things that changes and in this way deal with the uncertainty when that happens.
Yeah, and you notice that there's nothing there about predicting the future. So the thing that I always emphasize about scenario analysis is that scenario analysis isn't about predicting the future. You can actually argue that scenario analysis is very little about the future at all. So the main reason, I would argue, why most scenario analysis happens has to do with the present. So it's about understanding what's going on now in the present better. And one way to understand what's going on now in the present better is to think creatively and expansively about different ways in which the future might unfold.
I see. Yeah, that's really interesting. Oh, do the companies or bigger companies, do they really live that? Or do they really see the necessity to have that philosophy? Because you can also have the philosophy, I don't know, like a strong hierarchy where the boss knows in which direction we have to go and everyone follows. How is your are your experiences with that kind of thinking in the real world?
I mean, I think there are definitely examples of firms where scenario analysis is built in. You know, it's part of the kind of analysis that's constantly undertaken. Mm-hmm. And I think firms that do scenario analysis well fit into that, fit into that kind of mold, if you like. I also think scenario analysis is something that's very important at government level. And it's something that happens a lot when governments horizon scan and sort of think about the future and about long-term approaches, preparations, opportunities and threats, things like that. So a lot of scenario analysis undoubtedly is carried out as a marketing exercise. And you have the production of a set of scenarios, glossy brochure, and that's that. That undoubtedly happens a lot.
I see.
I would argue that for scenario analysis to be successful, really successful, and really do the things that it's sold as doing, it needs to be a kind of constant process. And the problem is, that's the reason why scenario analysis is very often thought of as being something that happens within large firms. Because doing scenario analysis properly requires quite a lot of people, and it requires quite a lot of time, and it takes senior, well-paid, important people within firms away from the operational front line, if you like. And that's difficult for small firms to do. So there are examples. There was one that was done for the city of Birmingham, near where I live, where you have a sort of pooling of resources and scenario analysis being done by and for groups of firms. However, generally, people think of scenario analysis as being something that's done within very large firms like Shell, because it takes a lot of resources, and it's companies like Shell that have the resources to be able to do it.
I see. And that's a great insight into this topic. And another research interest of yours is also management and political economy in Latin America. And how does that come, and what your greatest learnings about that, if we can start it like that?
So I suppose my relationship with Latin America goes back a long way. So I've worked in higher education for 11 years now. Mm-hmm. Before I did that, I spent 11 years as a political risk analyst consultant. So I worked for a couple of firms, most recently Oxford Analytica. And my focus throughout that time was Latin America. So basically what I was doing was writing analysis, commissioning analysis from other people, and that was being read by corporate and government clients.
Can I imagine that it's also like kind of scenario analysis, where you go through different directions and analyze the situations? Or
that's where the interest in scenario analysis came. Basically what clients are looking for in that world is what's known as forward-looking analysis. They're looking for judgment. And very often these companies talk about predictive judgment. So I've just talked about not being able to predict the future. These companies are some of the worst culprits in terms of claiming to be able to predict the future. Mm-hmm. So they sell kind of predictive judgments about the future. And a lot of that is done basically without any formal methodology or training. So it's based on the expert's judgment of sometimes quite an instinctive expert judgment on what's likely to happen next. But that interest in Latin America goes back a very long way to when I was in my teens. I suppose working in the political risk field is where the interest in scenario analysis and foresight came from.
Okay. And you mean it started young and it's still something that's still interesting for you, right? And what are the elements where you can say these are really the things that keeps that interest in you?
So, I mean, I think it's a real privilege to be able to work on something that you're passionate about. Not many people have that. I sort of discovered the Spanish language, when I was about 13 and fell in love with it, basically. Mm-hmm. When I was 16, I got to attend an international school in New Mexico, quite near the US-Mexican border. And I sort of discovered Latin America. And my interest in Latin America wasn't really about politics or economics. It was a little bit about, you know, like many people at the age of sort of 16, 17, mm-hmm. I was interested in particularly left-wing politics. I found the story of Cuba and what had happened in Cuba very interesting. It was towards the end of the civil wars in Central America of the 1980s, and again I found that interesting. But fundamentally my interest in Latin America was about things like music. It was culture. So still, you know, one of the things that I really, really love in general is Latin American music, particularly Brazilian music, but music from throughout Latin America. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that plus the language kind of sparked an interest, which I was able to pursue through university. So I did a degree in Latin American studies. Mm-hmm. And I did a PhD in Latin American studies, sadly a subject area that barely exists in UK higher education these days. And then that led into the political risk world. And then that led to business school higher education and interests around sort of international business and scenario analysis. So a lot of what happened there was a combination of chance and luck, being in the right place at the right time, seizing opportunities, I guess, although very often I didn't realize at the time how significant those opportunities were. But Latin America has been a thread that runs through it. So I haven't done a huge amount of academic writing on Latin America, although I was involved recently in editing a book about corporate governance in Latin America. However, I do a lot of work with universities in Latin America, and it brings a slightly different perspective on international business that I use particularly in my teaching. So I think I personally think it adds value to what I do in the classroom, that having spent a lot of time in Latin America and having spent a lot of time thinking about the region and what goes on there and why things happen, I probably come at international business, what goes on within multinational firms, how foreign investment works, all of that sort of thing, from a slightly different perspective.
Okay, what are these learnings that you could grasp and then use it actually, or these moments where you say, okay, that's the thing that has influenced me from my time there, and that kind of knowledge that you say, okay, that's how I do it now different, or what are these kind of insights that you have or learnings?
I mean, I think, for example, when I teach, for example, so at the moment I teach a course on international strategy. Very often when I'm talking to students on that course, I'm coming at it from the perspective of Latin American firms or from firms doing business in Latin America. And that looks quite different. So, for example, in Latin America, family firms are far more common than they are in the UK and the US. Not just family firms, family conglomerates. So basically what you have are big business groups where you have a single family that either owns or controls the different elements. Okay. But you have, you know, you might have a bank, a major retailer, firms in the professional services space, and you have a portfolio of lots of different kinds of firms in lots of different kinds of sectors. And that is a very common way in which business is organized in Latin America. It's not a very common way to organize business here. There are remarkably few big family firms in the UK. So when I'm thinking about strategy and foreign investment and things like that, I'm thinking about it from a slightly different perspective. I also think that, for example, it's interesting that if you look within Latin America, you have a number of big Latin American firms that operate across multiple countries in that region. You have relatively few Latin American firms that have managed to establish themselves and operate successfully outside of the Latin American region.
Oh, okay.
And again, I'm not saying that there are none, there are some. So Embraer, the Brazilian aircraft manufacturer, is certainly an example. Cemex has been an example, but they're relatively rare. And again, I think that's interesting. And what I hope is that that gives a slightly different perspective when talking about things like how multinational firms behave, how they enter new markets, how they make investment decisions, which are the sort of things that are covered in typical international business courses.
Oh, wow, that would be so interesting to know more about, but I think that would be too much detail. But maybe in short, maybe if we can look at the strengths and weaknesses of these Latin American firms, what would you say are the strengths that, I don't know, European firms can learn from, if I can use the term European firms, because maybe that's also too heterogeneous to say that or to describe that. But what are the things you say we can learn from them, and what are things, I'll call them weaknesses now, what you would say are there that they can improve?
So I think business in general, firms are very much a product of the environments in which they operate. And it's really important to understand how institutions work in the countries and regions where you're operating. And it's also really important to understand cultural issues. So I always argue that business is fundamentally about relationships. I continue to believe that very strongly. Business is fundamentally about relationships and whether or not a business venture is successful or not, especially a business venture involving more than one partner, very often depends on the quality of the relationship between the people who are seeking to do business. Mm-hmm. And I would argue, I haven't published on this, but I would argue that when we look at Latin American firms and what makes some of them successful in Latin America but not outside Latin America, my starting point in understanding that would be that it's all about institutions. And it's about navigating the kind of institutional landscape in Latin America, involving a very deep understanding of that landscape and how it works and how the relationships work, but that not really translating very well outside of the region. So I would see that the role of institutions and relationships, I would see being really important in terms of understanding why business is done the way it is in Latin America.
There's certain key elements where you say that's typical of these institutions there, how they work. Is there something like that?
I mean, I think that there are a series of actors that are really, really important. So government actors are important. The kind of corporate elites are very important. In some parts of Latin America and in some sectors, unions are important. And there's a lot of work on different aspects of business and indeed society in Latin America that talk about coalitions, that basically you have these sorts of relationships and the way that things get done and the way that things run smoothly and successfully is by effectively kind of navigating the politics, if you like, of keeping those relationships together. So I think that's really important. Now, it's not just in Latin America that family firms are the kind of dominant corporate form. So in a lot of Europe, family firms are really important as well. What makes Latin America interesting, I think, is the nature of these huge corporate conglomerate business groups. And they have a couple, the fact that you have these sort of, in a lot of countries in the region, you have a relatively small number of gigantic firms run by individual families that are, if you like, the kind of backbone of the economies of their countries, of those countries. And that, on the one hand, leads to a degree, or has led to a degree of continuity that's quite interesting. So it's well known that basically family firms or family-owned firms tend to have longer-term perspectives when they make things like investment decisions, because they don't have to worry so much about returns to shareholders, etc. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the case in Latin America as well. These diversified conglomerates, so kind of big business groups with firms from lots of different sectors, that allows a sort of sharing of know-how and even to some extent a sharing of resources that's really important. But then you have the issue of the emergence of kind of corporate giants, which are very, very big, very, very powerful. And for example, if you look at Brazil, there's a fabulous book written by a former Reuters journalist called Brazilianaires, which looks at the Brazilian corporate elite and does a sort of deep dive into the life story of some of the richest people in Brazil. And, you know, you see a really pretty sordid story of political corruption, impunity, etc., etc., which is a major sort of negative in term, which permeates through the quality of institutions within a country, the nature of inequality, the effect that inequality has on society. So again, you look at Brazil, and levels of, in particular, urban crime are very, very high in Brazil at the moment.
Really, very high.
Yeah, there's a debate about why that's the case. I would argue that it's fundamentally about inequality.
Are there any means to now to do something against it, or is it something that people accept?
I don't think people accept it. So I've heard arguments from the vantage point of London that corruption and violence are somehow embedded in Latin American culture. I don't believe that's the case. People who I work with and am friends with across Latin America, I think, would take issue with the idea that there's some sort of embedded corruption and that people are just used to violence. The problem is that there are an awful lot of vested interests which act against fundamental change. And where fundamental change happens, it's often not clear whether it's as fundamental as it seems. So we heard a lot in the first decade of the 2000s, for example, about a Peruvian economic miracle and how Peru, which is probably the country I know best in Latin America, Peru, when I first knew it, which was the early to mid 90s, was extremely violent, unsafe, unequal, etc., unstable, etc., etc. Peru appeared to reinvent itself in the first decade and a half of the 2000s with sort of sustained quite high growth, an apparently more diversified economy, apparently stronger institutions. And what we saw since the late 2010s was that a lot of this was an illusion. So in Peru currently, if I'm not mistaken, there is not a single living former president who isn't in jail, for example. And that sort of highlights just how entrenched corruption has been. And there was a massive corruption scandal involving a Brazilian construction firm, which was related to that. You see that, okay, on one level, it may look as though there is a higher level of economic wealth than there was in the 90s. It may look as though in some parts of cities, insecurity is less of an issue than it was in the late 90s, but actually that insecurity has changed. So it's not that the country is less unsafe, it's that the nature of that insecurity has changed. Likewise, at the moment, I've never been to El Salvador, but what's happening in El Salvador at the moment is fascinating. So El Salvador, for a long time now, has had a problem with gangs. And with extreme levels of gang violence. There's been a lot of migration from El Salvador to the United States, and fundamentally that's about people escaping from gang violence. There is the current president of El Salvador appears to have managed to get this problem under control.
How does he do that?
And he appears to have done that by essentially taking an incredibly hard line with gangs. Sort of zero tolerance approach, has built a massive new prison that has capacity for 40,000 people. And, you know, the guy is fated, not just in El Salvador, but in quite a lot of Latin America, as visionary, because he's managed to do this.
But it's an illusion, you say.
it's not yet clear. It's not clear whether it's an illusion or, and if it's illusion, how it's illusion, an illusion. But successive lead political leaders in El Salvador and elsewhere have talked about taking a hard line on crime and locking up gangsters and things like that, and it hasn't worked. And there has been an accusation from the Biden administration in the US that what this guy's actually doing is negotiating with the gangs. And that the hard line is indeed a bit of an illusion. There are issues about human rights as well. And again, you know, what I suspect that we're going to have there is something that looks like a miracle, and people talk about it being a miracle at the moment. If you look for videos on El Salvador on YouTube, you see loads of accounts of how parts of cities that were too dangerous to go into are suddenly really safe. Mm-hmm. You know, the murder rate hasn't just fallen, it's collapsed. You know, that it's incredibly low, and it's just not clear what's going on. And I think this, you know, I think these stories are quite common in Latin America. Mm-hmm. So to go back to the question of what can be done about these issues of urban violence, corruption, things like that, there might appear to be a response to that in El Salvador. But things may not turn out to be as they seem. In other countries, the sort of sheer scale of the vested interests involved and the sheer power of some of the organized criminal groups involved make it very difficult to do anything mm-hmm. about this challenge.
Yeah. It's interesting insight. And yeah, how do you research in this field, right? So how do you get actually information to, because it's really hard, I feel, to get information, but you have to start from somewhere. How do you filter this information too?
I mean, so first of all, what I would say is, you know, my current role, which is as head of education and student experience, means that the amount of actual academic research that I do these days is less than I would like, simply because I'm sort of focused on the institution building side of university life. I think in terms of the work that I've done in the past on Latin America, the only thing that you can do is to look at a variety of sources. Mm-hmm. Have a very critical perspective when scrutinizing those sources, and also talking to people mm-hmm. as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Pre-pandemic, I used to try to go there once or twice a year. Mm-hmm. Ideally, I would like to go there more. That hasn't been possible since the pandemic.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Again, I think when, you know, if you're interested in a particular part of the world, or if you're just interested in international affairs, be they business or other international affairs, actually going there is really important. Mm. And there are technological alternatives to going places at the moment, but only up to a point.
Mm-hmm. So is it like you need this kind of connection to the people, and this just happens if you really there and talk with them face to face, or is it more?
Yeah, it's partly that. It's also about understanding how people tick, mm-hmm. understanding what, mm-hmm. you know, that there's a whole, so another area that I'm very interested in, this is more a personal interest than a professional interest, is language. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of different elements to language. One thing is the whole idea of context and the relationship between what people say and what people mean. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to really grasp that without spending a lot of time with people. The obvious way to spend a lot of time with people is by going somewhere.
Right, I totally agree with that. So the hidden meanings or the cultural context, it's so difficult to understand.
Yeah.
Nice. And yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you about what you think about the future. But what I've learned today is that prediction of future is not possible. So maybe I ask it differently. What do you think are the main drivers for the future? I don't know, if we look at the time for, I don't know, 10 years. So maybe it's, if we compare this, what were your main events or main changings that you see in the last 10 years? And based on that, what do you think will have the biggest impact? And in which direction in the next 10 years?
So, I mean, I think that we're on the cusp of a major paradigm shift at the moment. So to sort of go back to my current core activity, which is effectively responsibility for education in a university faculty of business and law, the thing that has absolutely blindsided the whole of education, especially higher education, in the past year has been the emergence of generative artificial intelligence. So essentially ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. That went from being something that was talked about in the abstract as being a potential problem for universities to being an actual problem for universities.
And that was also like a kind of surprise for uni. For
almost, the speed with which it happened was definitely a surprise for universities. Mm-hmm. So the speed with which we went from talking about how well there are tools that can be used that can write work for people to people, not just people using them, but a lot of people using them, and us not really being able to detect whether someone was using them, that happened very quickly. It's very, very clear to me that artificial intelligence is going to be important. That's an obvious thing to say. Mm-hmm. Artificial intelligence and the use of artificial intelligence is going to be the big thing that shapes what the world looks like.
Yeah. Do you have feeling that it's more a positive change or a negative change?
I think there are opportunities and threats, and I don't know whether it's positive or negative. I can see significant positives and negatives. Mm-hmm. So, for example, to go back to the area of language, I now use an artificial intelligence tool to practice various languages that I speak, and it's a complete game changer being mm-hmm. able to have a conversation with an artificial intelligence mm-hmm. bot. And that is the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we will be able to do with artificial intelligence in the area of education. Mm-hmm. And education is just one area. This is happening very, very quickly. So, you know, we've got ChatGPT-4, which is orders of magnitude more sophisticated than ChatGPT. ChatGPT-5 will be more sophisticated again. Mm-hmm. And the big uncertainty for me is what happens as artificial intelligence becomes exponentially more sophisticated.
What happens? Okay. So in both directions, opportunities and threats.
It's very interesting because, you know, I talked a while ago about scenario analysis and plausibility. Mm-hmm. Once you start talking about artificial intelligence, you very quickly get to the boundaries of plausibility. But essentially, it would seem to me that we are closer than people realize to a situation where artificial intelligence potentially stops being artificial.
What do you mean by that?
I mean artificial intelligence tools develop an ability to act autonomously. And, you know, things that I follow in this area suggest that we're pretty close to that. So, you know, there's a documented example, for example, of an artificial intelligence tool lying in order to perform a task. That has already happened.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, once you get to that degree of sophistication with artificial intelligence, then it becomes very uncertain and very unpredictable. So the thing that I would say with a degree of confidence, I mean, 10 years ago, I would have said that a lot of what would define the coming 10 years would be technological.
Mm-hmm.
It has been. I think that's going to remain the case. And I think that it's not just technological, but related to artificial intelligence. How artificial intelligence changes the nature of the world that we live in is, I would be pretty confident that it will change the world that we live in. How it does that is a very open question, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I'm also excited how the next 10 years are, because if I look back the last 10 years, okay, you don't, if you think more about it, maybe there's changes, but somehow it doesn't feel like a real change. And now the next 10 years really feel like a bigger change that really I'm more strongly to feel. I don't know, that's my feeling now, but excited also to see how it changed and how we can affect, or if we have any impact on that.
Indeed.
Yeah. And to close the conversation today, I always ask for a song for my playlist. And you are a fan of music, so do you have any good songs recommendations for me?
A song from a playlist? Almost all the music that I listen to these days is Brazilian. And my way into Brazilian music was a musician called Caetano Veloso, who's now, he's touring Europe at the moment. He's 81 years old and is still doing remarkably creative things at the age of 81. Mm-hmm. A much younger samba performer called Xande de Pilares produced an album recently of songs, of his interpretations of songs by Caetano Veloso. And it's both really, really fresh and interesting, while very faithful to the original work at the same time. So that's not especially, there's no particular significance to those songs, but that's the most exciting thing that I've listened to at the moment. In general, one of the things that got me interested in Brazilian music was, I would argue the golden age of Brazilian music was during the military dictatorship in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole generation of Brazilian musicians who wrote songs that were protest songs disguised as innocuous, sort of meaningless songs, mm-hmm, that didn't get picked up by the censors. And the way that this was done was, you know, I hear these songs,
mm-hmm,
and hear how sharp the protest is, but how cleverly it's disguised.
Okay.
And that kind of encompasses to me why Latin American culture is so exciting.
Wow, I can feel the fire. Yeah. So Neil, thank you today so much for this conversation.
No, and thank you. It's been really interesting.
Yeah, and hope to see you soon. And thanks again for this insight and knowledge that you shared.
No, it's a pleasure.
Today.
Thank you.
That's it for today's episode. If you like this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. If you got any thoughts on this episode or any ideas for new podcast topics, feel free to send a voice message. Alternatively, you can drop a tweet or DM on Twitter. Maybe you even like to join for an episode. Links are also in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.